Greetings and good evening, everyone, and welcome back to the Mark Fraley Podcast. Today is August 29th, 2017, a bright and sunny Tuesday here in Nashville, thankfully not as hot as it's been. Last week, of course, was a very exciting week here in Tennessee with a total eclipse of the sun occurring on Monday. I recorded two interviews last week, and I'm just now getting back to my home studio to get them edited and posted to the web. I hope my listeners will indulge me, as this week's podcast will be a little bit of a change of pace. I will be putting my attorney hat back on and interviewing my friend Larry Hager. Larry is a Nashville lawyer and a member of our city council. He represents the Hermitage area. His family has been in Davidson County and in the Hermitage area for several generations, and many of his family have been attorneys and judges. Larry is among a very short list of Nashville attorneys that I would call street lawyers. That means that he does a very general practice involving representing actual people, not necessarily corporations. His practice involves representing defendants in criminal matters, and plaintiffs in personal injury and workers' compensation cases. He also handles wills and probate and divorce and other matters. I wanted to get him in and discuss with him the changes in the law that have occurred over the past 30 years that he's been practicing. These changes have often been made, have made the lawyer's job more difficult, and changes have been made which tend to favor business interests over interests of common citizens and consumers. And so, I hope you'll enjoy my interview with Larry Hager. So, Larry Hager, welcome to the Mark Fraley Podcast.
Thank you very much. Right. Glad to be here.
Thrilled that you took some time out of your schedule to talk with me.
Sure.
Larry, I wanted to, before we go too much further, I want my audience to get a notion of who you are and what your background is. I know you're a local Middle Tennessean, Nashvillian. Tell us about that.
I'm a seventh generation Nashvillian. I go back to the late 1700s. If you know where John Hager Road is, out in Hermitage, that's the old family farm. Hollis Hager was my great-great-great-grandfather, who was born in 1801, died in 1870. He was a magistrate and a lawyer for Chancellor Turner here in Nashville. I went to McGavick High School.
Your great-grandfather.
Great-great-grandfather.
Great-great-grandfather. Yeah. Wow.
And then I went to McGavick High School. I then worked at Beatrice Foods. And then I went to Belmont, which is Belmont University now. Business administration degree, poli-sci minor. Then I went to work full-time for Beatrice Foods over shipping and receiving. Stayed there two or three years, and then I went to Kroger's. I was a transportation supervisor at Kroger's. Went back to law school at night. I had about 140 Teamster truck drivers working for me at that time. And then I started out with Judge Mark Fishburne, was my first law partner.
I'd forgotten that.
So Judge Mark Fishburne was my first law partner. I started out doing probably a general practice. And I still do a general practice, so I'm here with Newald, Hager, Underhill, and Evans now.
Well, you and I have something in common in that we both went to the Knight Law School.
Correct.
I graduated there in 83, and I think you were the year after me.
84. That's correct. I was the one riding the motorcycle that parked out back.
Well, I didn't remember that. But in those days, we went to school at the old downtown Y, didn't we?
That's correct.
Okay. From 7 to or 6:30 to 10 at night or something like that?
Correct.
At night for 4 years.
4 years.
Okay. But you had a career or a couple careers before you actually were a lawyer.
Correct.
And I'll bet you that experience with Kroger and with Beatrice informs your interactions with your clients.
It's invaluable.
Tell me.
Well, from the standpoint of knowing how to work with people, how to manage people. And then before that, I was in a union, so I was a union employee with AFL-CIO. So I've worked both sides of that, being a union employee then going into management. Kroger's, of course, working at Kroger's, I learned all of these. I had to learn all your OSHA regulations, DOT regulations. So in my private law practice, when I get involved with any type of truck accidents with cars or things of that nature, I already know all the regulations, the OSHA and DOT. So it makes it easier for me to see if there's been any violations of the trucking company as far as OSHA or DOT regulations.
Okay. We were talking before we got started about the changes in the law since you and I started practice. Now, I stayed in government, state government for a couple of years before I came out and started practice. But,
right.
You know, when you come out of law school, you really know more law than you'll ever know. And you're able to get into several different kinds of things. But you, more than a lot of lawyers I know, have maintained more of a general practice. Tell us what the scope of your practice is now.
Mostly my practice is I do criminal still.
Okay.
Don't do any murders or rape cases. Mostly okay. Do the DUIs, assaults, drug cases, things of that nature. Okay. I still do domestic law. I do probate law, the administration of estates. I do personal injury, and I do workers' comp. That's probably the biggest areas that I practice in.
Right. And that's a lot of things to keep aware of, the changes in the law and the nuances of the rules and things that change from year to year.
That's correct.
Yeah. Was your practice at one time even broader than that?
Yeah, one time I did some bankruptcy law, and the problem with that, when you're doing a federal and state practice, the rules in federal court are totally different. So every time I was doing bankruptcy, I did them for about 10 years, they would change the rules, and finally I just decided, you know, I need to drop something because of going back and forth from federal court to state court. I think you really have to specialize in either state or federal court because of the rules changing constantly in both state and federal court.
When you and I got out of law school, the rules in plaintiff's work, and I mean personal injury and workers' comp type work, were somewhat favorable to plaintiffs.
That's correct.
Tell us, if you can, about the changes in the rules, you know, that have to do with so-called tort reform and workers' comp reform.
Well, you know, as you know, the legislature has, you know, they've put a cap on personal injury lawsuits now, $750,000 for pain and suffering, and loss of enjoyment of life. There is an escape clause for that, but it has to be one of those catastrophic type cases. So I think that was a big push by the by your lobbyists for doctors and things of that nature, and that's what that came about. So
insurance company.
Correct. I didn't want to say that, but I will. It's insurance companies.
Right.
And then, of course, you had workers' comp. And since Governor Bredesen was in office, you know, they changed the workers' comp law, less compensation. And then when Governor Haslam came in, they reformed it again. We used to go to court on work comp. Now we don't. We have administrative law judges. And the amount that the injured employee gets is a lot less than it used to be. So that's had an effect on your injured workers in the state of Tennessee. But at the same time, I understand what the governors were trying to do was make it a more employee-friendly state to bring in more business, which I think that has occurred to some degree. But
were trying to make it a state that was was more attractive to business and industry coming into the state.
That's correct.
Because there was a perception that the costs of maintaining workers' comp insurance was too high, that sort of thing.
That's correct. Right. That's correct.
Have you ever had the impression that there was an actual relationship between the claims paid and actually the rates of insurance?
Not really.
Yeah, that's been my impression as well.
I think what's hurt it more than anything else is your medical costs. Medical costs has just went out the roof here in the last 10 years. So when you look at the claims and what they're paying out in medical costs, yeah, there's been a dramatic increase in medical costs. Mm-hmm. No doubt about that. I don't think they pay out near the amount they do on claims, but I don't see the difference in the premiums going down as much as everybody thought they would.
Right. So in the old days, an employee got injured on the job. They went through their rehabilitation period and got certified as reaching maximum medical improvement.
Correct.
And then there was an opportunity for the attorney to sit down with the defense, the employer, and work out some sort of a compromise or an arrangement, settlement.
Correct.
And failing that, then it would go into actual state court.
That's correct.
And those cases were not heard by a jury, as I recall.
That's correct.
They were just heard by a judge.
That's correct.
But they, depending on which judge you drew, some of the judges had a reputation for being quite generous to employees.
That's correct. Yeah. You had your conservative judges and your more liberal judges.
Right.
Yeah.
So the intent of the reform was to take it out of the judge's hands and put it into administrative hands where there'd be more consistency in the results.
That's correct.
Okay.
And then less benefits.
Right.
As well at the same time.
So what's the role of the lawyer now in a workers' comp?
Well, it depends. You know, what I tell people is you have to look at it and say, okay, what's your impairment rating? If they have a very low impairment rating, I usually try to advise them, especially if they go back to work. I try to advise them that's a case that you can probably settle on your own because it's pretty cut and dry. Okay. Unless you fit certain factors like age, education, things of that nature, okay, that would bump it up a little bit more. So I look at those factors and I say, okay, if you don't meet those factors and you're back at work and you've got a low impairment rating, then you really don't need a lawyer in that situation. The AMA guidelines, you know.
The American Medical Association guidelines.
We use the 6th edition guidelines now. They're pretty conservative. And normally you can look at those guidelines when the doctor gives the impairment and say if it's in line with what the guidelines call for. If it doesn't, then you can always go send somebody out for an independent medical exam. But, you know, if you read the American Medical Association guidelines enough, you pretty well know what the impairment's going to be.
Right. Now, in a situation where someone has a, not a catastrophic injury, but one that would disable them for work, that's a whole different situation.
That's permanent total disability.
Right. And how is that compensated now?
It's the same thing. 66 and two-thirds are average weekly wage. Okay. And then, of course, every year, if you get permanent total disability, every year they review it to see if that person is able to go back to work or be rehabilitated. That was the only drawback about permanent total disability years ago.
It's not really permanent.
Right, because they're going to review you every year.
Right.
And if you can get, you know, if it's 3 years down the road and they say, okay, you can go do this, this, or this, then they can go back and try to cut off those benefits.
Reopens the case.
Correct.
Without really any additional compensation for the lawyer to come in and assist.
That's correct.
All right. So the plaintiff's at a serious disadvantage in that situation.
Correct. That's right.
It's an interesting situation, but it's. Would you say that it makes having access to a lawyer more difficult for the injured?
It can, because we have to look at the economics of it.
Right.
And you have to look at it and say, well, you know, when you look at a case like, say, you know, 8-9 years ago, rotator cuff tear, you know, a lawyer, you could look at it and probably get $15,000 to $20,000 settlement, whereas now you might only get $7,000 to $10,000 if they're back at work. So a lot of it's just you got to look at your economics and whether it's really worth the lawyer's time to open the file and work with it.
Right. What's happened in the law of family law, domestic relations or divorce and custody, those sorts of fields? Now, I remember when the child support guidelines mm-hmm. first came in, and I guess it was 87 or 88.
Mm-hmm.
But there's been a whole lot of changes in that field.
Yeah. I think, you know, the biggest changes with divorce now is the required 2 hours of mediation with a mediator that's certified. You know, probably 95% of your divorce cases get settled now before you go to trial. The permanent parenting plan, I think, is working out the way the legislature intended, where people, father and mother, can sit down and work out a parenting plan. And, you know, the court looks at it, so it's fair, it's fine with the court. So what the new law has done is tried to entice people to sit down and work out these differences without going to court and airing out your dirty laundry and dragging this all through the court. It's like I tell people, when you've got children, there's one thing you can't change. You know, that you're the mother of the child and he's the father of the child. And the quicker y'all learn to get together and work together to raise these children, the better off you're going to be. Otherwise, you're going to be in court every year fighting over something. And I think it still takes both parents to raise your children properly.
In the instance of a divorce case where there's just a husband and wife, no children, and they enter into a marital dissolution agreement, there's no need for any kind of mediation in that instance.
As long as they enter into the marital dissolution agreement. And, of course, now, you know, the Supreme Court has the forms. It makes it really easy if two people don't have children and don't have real estate. You can get the forms off the Supreme Court website and do the divorce yourself, an uncontested divorce.
Well, that's an interesting notion. I didn't know that you could do that.
Yes, sir.
And I can remember, and you remember quite well, I'm sure you do, how poorly treated people representing themselves were in divorce court some years ago.
Right.
I won't mention the name of the particular judge.
Right.
But she would quiz them about where they got the paperwork and
right.
that sort of thing. But they're actually encouraging self-help in these
sure.
in this instance.
If you go up to Judge Robinson's court now, Philip Robinson,
okay.
He's real good about people coming up there pro se litigants.
Okay.
And it makes it easy if they don't have children, don't have real estate. I recommend people sometimes, if they don't have the money, go do it yourself.
And these are probably close to the same forms that lawyers have used for many years.
Similar, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah.
Okay. Just sort of fill in the blanks and go on with the next one.
Correct.
That's so interesting. Conservatorships.
Yeah.
I know that the law was changed some years ago, probably 15 or 20 years ago.
Right.
As a result of some wrongdoing on the part of people that had been appointed conservator and some of their attorneys.
Right.
The law is much stricter now in the governance of conservatorships.
Right.
Tell us about your experience in that these days.
You know, you still have to have a physician certify that the person needs a conservator.
Okay.
For both their finances or whatever. You still have your guardian ad litem. And then, of course, they can be an advocate appointed as well if they determine that the person really doesn't need a conservator.
All right, let's break that down a second. So if you've got an aging parent mm-hmm. who you feel needs a conservator,
right.
You'd have to go and get his personal physician or some doc, some MD.
Correct.
To fill out the form that says this person is in need.
Correct.
And there's kind of a checkbox where the doctor says, well, he might be able to make his decisions about, you know, what his medicines are, but he won't be able to make his decisions about his finances or
Correct.
Breaking it down
Correct.
That way.
They can break that down.
Right. Then the court would appoint usually a lawyer who is someone called a guardian ad litem.
That's correct.
All right. What's the role of the guardian ad litem?
They're to investigate the situation and determine if this person really needs a conservator or not. They would interview the ward, which is the person you're getting a conservator for. They would interview the doctor and look at the medical records. Based on that, they'd make a report back to the court that this person...
Sort of acting on behalf of the court, eyes and ears of the court.
That's correct.
Okay.
That's correct.
And in most cases, the guardian ad litem will more usually say, yes, there is a need, or maybe modify the need in some
way. Correct. But for the most part, what I see up there is most of the time, you know, the person does need a conservator.
Right.
They're getting to, you know, a lot of your dementia, Alzheimer's,
right.
You see a lot of that, things of that nature. And then, of course, you still have, like I have, you know, a handicapped son that's 26. Me and my wife are the conservator for him.
Okay. And you have to file an annual report.
That's correct.
Yep, exactly.
That's correct.
So tell us what's the latest in the criminal law field.
Well, they had an opinion come out the other day where now the defendant can bring in the social media information of the victim of the crime, which is kind of interesting. The court said they're allowed to do that.
All right. Well, give me a for instance where that might come in. Give me a fact
well,
situation.
You've got a victim that claims that this person assaulted them or did something. Then they've got maybe something in their social media or something on their phone that contradicts what they said for impeachment purposes.
Okay.
All right. The criminal law, of course, the DUIs, you know, it's still .08 for driving under the influence. And of course, everybody now,
blood alcohol.
Yeah. And if you get a DUI, everybody has to have the interlock system in their vehicle to blow in before they can drive the vehicle.
So the interlock is a mechanical switch,
right?
Into which you blow and it samples,
right.
to assure that you're not drunk,
right.
Before, and it won't let you start the car unless you're clear.
And it'll go off random while you're driving too, and you have to blow in it. So it does a random check.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Oh yeah, it'll do a random check. It also takes a picture of you now.
Oh, as you're doing it?
Yeah.
So they know who it was that blew it?
That's correct. You got that in there now. That's all set up. And it runs about $75 a month to have that. But, of course, you're not restricted. You can drive anywhere, anytime you want to go.
Okay.
It's a pretty good tool, I guess, just to ensure to the public that the person's not out here driving under the influence. I'm seeing a uptick, though, in DUIs of people on narcotic medications.
Okay.
I'm getting older people, and that's something I want to warn them about, that I've had probably three cases in the last 6 months of older people on narcotic medication. They haven't been drinking. They get pulled over. They're weaving or something, gives the officer probable cause, and they'll say, well, I haven't been drinking, but I'm on this medication, which is prescription medication. The problem is it's narcotic medication. And they submit to the blood test, and it comes back, and they're at therapeutic levels, which, under the law, it impairs your ability to drive a vehicle. So I'm seeing a lot more of that than I have in the past.
Or a little bit of the narcotic medication, and even the slightest bit of alcohol. And
correct.
You're impaired.
Correct.
Right.
Correct.
Combination of medicines.
So I always tell people that, you know, be wary of the medications you take and then you drive a vehicle. Because, you know, most of them have a warning on there that says, you know,
right. Caution
using machinery or driving a vehicle.
Right.
But I'm seeing a lot more of that here lately than I have probably in the last 10 years. It's becoming pretty prevalent, you know.
As Nashville grows, the growth in Nashville has just been incredible.
Yeah.
How has your practice changed with that?
Yeah, you know, it's pretty similar. I'm still what I call just a family lawyer. I get most of my business from referrals. Now I see a lot of people, because of the influx of new people coming in, a lot of the advertising has increased by certain lawyers, but you know, it's just something I've never had to do. I just go by referrals, do people a good job, competent job, and do the best I can for them.
So you've been in practice now
32 years.
32 years. Is it more challenging now?
It can be, but I think it's more complicated. because of all the new rules, like going to mediation, filing certain type of motions or notices, especially in domestic work. You know, you've got to do health insurance notices. You got to go to mediation. So I tell people it's a little bit more complicated, but very similar. I don't see as much litigation as I used to because of mediation. Even on the personal injury side, we have to go to mediation. You have to go to mediation in divorces. So the one thing I don't see that's mandatory mediation is, of course, the criminal law. You know, you don't see mandatory mediation. There was discussion at one time about doing mediation in certain assault cases, but I think that never did mature into any other discussion.
So what do you think the future is for young lawyers in just generally the law business? Do you think that there's a future in being a generalist as you are?
I think so. I mean, I've got my son, I just put him in UT this weekend, and he's wanting to be a lawyer. I think there's still room for it, like your probate work. There'll always be that type of work. There'll be criminal law work. There'll still be domestic work, domestic relations. I think intellectual property law is becoming a big area. I think that's open to new lawyers that want to do that type of law. Bankruptcy law will still be around. Personal injury will still be there, but I said this to my law partner years ago, as cars got safer with the airbags and the crash test and the way cars are developed nowadays, you see cars that are totally totaled out and people walk away without any injuries at all.
Right.
And that's because the lawyers have filed lawsuits against car manufacturers to make these cars safer. You see it with lawnmowers. You know, they've made lawnmowers safer because of lawsuits. Lawyers said, hey, y'all can make a safer product. So as products get safer, you're not going to see as many personal injury lawsuits as you used to. Workers' comp will still be there, but it's just not as lucrative as it used to be.
Right.
So real estate law is still a good law to be in. So, yeah, there's still room for openings for lawyers to come in and practice.
You know, there are great law firms in Nashville that handle corporate matters and that sort of thing. You know, the firms, the Bassberry and Sims and those sorts of Stites and Harbison, right. Those sorts of large firms. They tend not to do the kind of things that you do.
Right.
Is that a general, would that be a fair general statement?
Pretty close.
All right.
Now you do have, they have their, you've got a lot of them in those big firms that still have their domestic law group and they have probate law groups.
Okay.
That still do a lot of that, but going to general sessions court and doing a lot of criminal, you don't see as much as that with
exactly.
The big firms.
And you, I would observe that I would tend to see folks that are graduates of the Nashville School of Law being more inclined to do the kind of things that you're into in terms of actual representing actual individuals,
right,
rather than corporations or
that. Yeah, and that's something I've always enjoyed coming out of the corporate field with Beatrice's and Kroger's. I always viewed myself as a people's lawyer.
Right.
I want to represent the people. And I think from that standpoint, I help a lot of people get through a lot of their problems in life. We all got problems.
Right.
And you've got to have somebody sometimes that's going to help you get through those rocky roads, and that's what I try to do.
Right. Well, that's certainly admirable, and it seems to me that tends to be the inclination of folks that are graduates of the Nashville School of Law.
It is.
Yeah.
Because we come from the backgrounds where we're all working people at one time,
right.
Just like me. Worked on the clock, and then I went into management. You know, I understand working in factories. I understand trucking industry. I understand all those things. I did construction work when I was younger for a union carpenter. So I've done that construction work too, part-time. So I understand the type of work that a lot of people do out here. It's hard work.
Exactly. All right. Well, Larry, I do thank you for the time you've spent
Sure.
with me. It's been an interesting interview. And maybe one of these days we'll come back and talk a little bit more about what you're doing with Metro Council.
That'll be great.
All right. Thanks, Larry.
Thank you. All right.